Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, it's Craig Fowler here. Before we get to tonight's show, let me tell you about our sponsors for this week. Manscaped, the men's below-the-waist grooming champions of the world! Manscaped offers precise engineered tools for your family jewels, and they have just launched their fourth-generation trimmer, the Lawnmower 4.0. Join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code TERRACE at manscaped.com. Now, I've been a massive advocate of Manscaped ever since I tried my first razor, as I no longer need to worry about nasty nicks when keeping my pubic region nice and neat. But let me tell you about the latest upgrades. The improved trimmer includes a multifunction on-off switch that can engage your travel lock, means it doesn't start vibrating in your bag. It also gives you the ability to turn the LED spotlight on and off when you need it for a more precise shave. The Lawnmower 4.0 even allows you to customize your trim through additional guard lengths with sizes 1 to 4. And how about wireless charging? The new wireless charging system uses electromagnetic induction, which can help battery length last longer. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code TERRACE at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code TERRACE. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped.
Hello and welcome to Thursday's edition of the Terrace Scottish Football Podcast. I am Craig Anderson and I'm joined today by Sean McGuigan.
Hello there.
And Sean, we are here to talk, amazingly, about a big Scotland away win. A one that I think we're both absolutely buzzing about.
Aye, and I must admit, Tuesday was set up, or I felt it was set up for myself, to be an evening of footballing misery. Raith Rovers away to Ayr at 6, and then Scotland away to Austria afterwards. And I thought this might not go well at all. However, I saw a defensive masterclass from three colossuses, if that's a word, colossuses, Kyle Benedictus, Christoph Berra and Grant Hanley. But regardless of the Raith Rovers performance, to see Scotland put in... Do you know something? Like, we know that Scotland can put in a performance like that. Like, we've seen it previously under Steve Clarke, but all too fleetingly. So, England away, Serbia away in terms of competitive games, maybe the Netherlands away if you want to include friendlies. So, we knew that they had a performance like that within them, but I must admit, I didn't see that coming. I mean, if you'd said to me a week previously, or less than a week, I think, at halftime in the Denmark game, if you'd said to me, right, within a week, we will have the playoff place within our own hands, I wouldn't have believed you because of how poorly we played against Denmark. And I know, as far as I'm concerned, part of the reason we played so poorly was because of how we were set up. But the fact that we were able to turn it round, and I know we had the Moldova game in between that I wasn't overly overly impressed by. But aye, that Austria game, I kind of thought, best case scenario, we might get a point. We might get a point. But how well we played, and I mean, it wasn't just a win. I felt it was a deserved win. And as much as we were, there was points in the game where I thought we were a wee bit deep, and I thought this could be a long night. No, I thought in terms of chances created, in terms of performances, we probably deserved the 3 points, and suddenly getting to the playoffs at least looks very much a possibility.
And I think that, I mean, that had to be the target. And realistically, we're a third seed, and yes, we were on paper when the groups got drawn, it looked like we were fortunate with a group in the sense that we didn't get a big name. We've subsequently seen that Denmark are actually maybe quite good. So again, second had to be the target, and we've got that in our grasp now. And I think it's a point in it, and I saw someone else make it, I can't remember who. This is why we hired Steve Clarke. We didn't hire Steve Clarke to beat Moldova 4-0. We hired Steve Clarke to get wins like that, to be able to go and beat Austria. And if that means you have to scrape shitey wins against Moldova rather than beating them comfortably, I'm willing to take it, because ultimately you get the same number of points no matter how many goals you beat the Minnows by, as long as you do beat them.
The thing is, I suppose what you could say about Steve Clarke as well is, so it's very encouraging that we are now at least competing. So obviously Austria were the number two seed, so we've taken 4 points off them. This is probably our biggest result against a fellow qualifier since beating Ireland at home, maybe. And in terms of beating somebody away from home in a kind of meaningful game, pass. I don't know. I can't remember the last time we beat. And in terms of a meaningful game, I can't remember the last time we beat a side that was seeded higher than us. This feels like a kind of massive result. What I would say about Steve Clarke is, and again, I don't necessarily want to get ahead of myself, but we generally now do take care of the lower seeds, and I were maybe not, we're maybe not disposing of them comfortably, but part of that comes down to the fact that we probably don't have a natural goal scorer. I think we have a strike force now that will kind of do and has their attributes. I'm not sure in scoring lots of goals are any of those attributes, but it's been rare for them to. Well, I think we've generally dispensed with all the kind of lower seeds so far, and obviously I hope that continues. But the reason I don't want to get too far ahead of myself is a record against Israel is
poor,
and a record against the two bottom seeds in the group is generally poor in terms of, it's quite rare for us to take full, like, 6 points out of six for the fifth seed and the sixth seed. So I'm certainly not taking anything for granted.
Yeah, I think it would be wrong to say otherwise. We are now the favourites in this group to finish second. I think that's fairly clear. All we need to do, and if you want to put it in that way, is win at home against an Israel team that, yes, we've had tangles with, but ultimately when we did overcome them in the playoffs, we did finish ahead of them in the Nations League twice. It's never been easy, but that's a game you would expect to win. That's a game that if the world cares, the world will still be expecting us to win. And then it's two away games against poor teams. That's all we need to do. If we get those 9 points, we will be second in the group. But as you say, I think there's a difference between saying that we're favourites and saying that it's going to be straightforward, because I don't think it's going to be straightforward. Ultimately, that Israel game will be a battle. If we win, it'll be by a goal. I'm pretty sure of that. I don't think we're going to go and smash them, because I don't think it's something we've got in us. That Dasa will no doubt just absolutely roast Andy Robertson for the a guy
infuriatingly
Vitesse Arnhem or whoever it is that he plays for. It's like he moved on. Actually, does he play for someone else better than that now? But anyway, he just constantly pops up, and I feel like I never see the back of the guy. Zahavi will score a goal, so it is just about hopefully our good players doing what they can do, and we know they can. And then, as you say, that sets up that. And I think actually, if we beat Israel, we can probably afford to draw one of those away games. I would rather we didn't, but we would actually probably put ourselves in a position where we could afford to. We don't want to. But we are getting ahead of ourselves with that. But so let's focus, I think, on Tuesday night. Focus on Scotland, Austria. So when the team came out, that was pretty much the exact team that I thought would play. What did you think?
No, I would have picked that side. I think. I mean, it's interesting in terms of the, I suppose maybe the debatable positions. I suppose that I hadn't realised that Patterson was kind of ruled out. It's interesting. I think so. I've never been. I don't know if anybody has ever been Stephen O'Donnell's biggest fan. Maybe you have been.
Me.
You are. But do you know something? And see if. I think there's lots of reasons to say that Nathan Patterson could be a decent right back going forward. However, I thought Patterson done a lot of things right against Moldova, but also thought he looked shaky at a lot of moments as well. And I think based on his defensive performance, Stephen O'Donnell was very good against Austria. But then he also, like, he got forward really well also. However, that, like, his final ball, like, was kind of lacking at times. But I didn't enjoy that time when he just, like, late in the game, when he just sprinted past Alaba. And I know it looked like he was the most exhausted man in the world, but he still got a shot off on target. So in terms of Stephen O'Donnell being right back, absolutely fine with that. Jack Henry at centre-half, I am not quite as assured about Jack Henry as the Scots Podcast Abroad Twitter feed is, or whatever it's called. And I have my reservations about him. However, I thought he defended very well, and that kind of settled my hash. I would be quite happy for him to continue as a Scotland centre-half, and I thought in terms of his defensive duties against Austria, he'd done very well. And he is another centre-half that can kind of come out with the football. And he isn't just like a big lump, which we've moaned about in terms of Scottish centre-halves. And then I suppose you're probably looking up front. So Lyndon Dykes and Che Adams are an interesting combination. I think both have their limitations. I think sometimes Lyndon Dykes doesn't necessarily play well for Scotland. However, I sometimes think we play better when he is in the team. And I think in terms of all the players that play up front for Scotland, so if you're looking at Dykes or Adams, or if we're asking Ryan Christie to be a kind of like play behind a striker, they all bring something to the party. But I do think Dykes and Adams, I suppose you could include Ryan Fraser, who for a wee spell, maybe, I don't know, a year ago, 18 months ago, him and Dykes looked like they had a really good understanding. But Adams and Dykes against Austria, they progressed us and they pushed us so much further up the park. And then when McGinn just behind them, there was so many examples of the three of them combining. And like McGinn had a couple of good opportunities. He probably should have scored at least one, maybe two. Adams had a couple of good opportunities again. Probably should have scored at least once. And that probably is why we struggle to put teams away or struggle to beat the minnows convincingly, because Adams, Dykes, McGinn, if you want to include them in a kind of forward trio, they're all very good and they certainly improve us, but they're not necessarily goal scorers. And that's the only thing that let us down. I mean, I thought defensively we're sound. I thought midfield was excellent. I don't always stick up for Callum McGregor. I thought he was excellent on the night. The only thing that let us down was we couldn't have put them away slightly earlier.
Yeah, and I think it's you're looking at the attacking players that we have in it, and there is a lot of that. There's a lack of refinement and a lack of goals, but a lot of endeavour and a lot of really good things. And people can look down their nose at that level of like endeavour, but there are very few players in world football that have what John McGinn has. Like, in terms of, it's hard to even describe. He's got, the Spanish would have a word for it, I'm sure, but we don't. But or the Germans maybe more likely. But he's energy, but it's all put to good use. It's not like wasted energy. Everything he does impacts the game so positively, John McGinn. And I don't think he's necessarily that good a footballer. I don't think he's the most talented. He's talented. He's all right, but it's about that clip of him at the end of the game where he skins the guy to go in towards goal, and then he like has the presence of mind to realize, well, the guy's just going to expect me to you know go towards goal here, so I'm just going to turn back away from him and just make sure we see this game out.
I went from being unbelievably nervous at that point to just bursting out laughing. See, as soon as he kind of doubled back on himself, just burst out laughing. I was like, that's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And yet, you always talk about we're a pessimistic nation. So you say, well, you know, we've got all that, but we're not scoring enough goals. And what happens if we start conceding them? What if it's the other way around? What if it's, well, we keep keeping all these clean sheets, but suddenly we do start scoring goals? That's possible. So you have to look at it. I think Adams has the potential in him. I think he's not maybe, as a goal scorer, really found it. I think he could have won that England game for us, particularly Adams had the best chances in that game. If he can step up goal scoring, because I think he's our most likely one as a guy that can get goals at this level, we do have a really strong attacking outlet now. And you think of when Steve Clarke took over, neither of those guys were playing for us. Neither of those guys were Scottish at the time, if you want to talk about it that way. Lyndon Dykes was, in fact, Lyndon Dykes had just completed a season with Queen of the South. Adams was, I think, at Birmingham, and neither of whom were playing for us. And we were looking at, you know, Naismith, McBurney, Burke, Eamon Brophy started Clarke's first game up front. In fact, we now have two really good, two international quality strikers, or two strikers that could be, like, you wouldn't look at them and go, well, he plays for QPR, he plays for Southampton, and go, right, fair enough, they are the sort of strikers you would expect a team at our level to have, which I don't think was the case previously. And yeah, I agree with you. Someone like O'Donnell, I think the people who... So I, again, I will go on record to say I am probably literally Stephen O'Donnell's biggest fan. I think people that criticise him don't actually watch him play and just have an idea of him in their head. Stephen O'Donnell is not a talented footballer. He's not he's not skilled on the ball or anything like that. But the amount of people who say, oh, well, he only defends, he doesn't get forward. Have you ever watched him? He's incredibly fit and he does get up and down the channel. You do see him in the final third all the time. Now, when he's in the final third, more often than not, especially at this level, he doesn't necessarily contribute what you would like him to, because maybe his final ball's not all there. Maybe he's not able to pick the pass. Maybe his decision-making isn't good. But he does get there. There's not a problem with Stephen O'Donnell getting into the final third. The problem is just what happens when he gets there. Ultimately, he was the right option for this game, even if Patterson was available, and he'll be the right option for several other games going forward. And I think people have to get used to that. Then you've got the other side of that defence. It's just incredibly strong. Robertson gets held to too high a standard, in the sense that people will say he doesn't play well for Scotland. And yes, again, he doesn't play as well as he does for Liverpool. But ultimately, you would very, very rarely do Andy Robertson make a mistake and let Scotland down. It happens occasionally. You talked about Patterson. Patterson was being judged against Moldova on the basis that he was a 19-year-old. And so when he did something well, it was over-egged to the point of, he's just a wee boy and he's managed to do that. Do you know what I mean? Whereas when he made a mistake, it was like he's ready to learn. And that's fine. I wanted Patterson to play the other night. It was a performance you would expect of a 19-year-old. The opposite is true of Robertson, where it's like when he does things competently, when he gets a 7 out of 10 performance, it's like, well, so what, he's a Liverpool captain? He's the Scotland captain who plays for Liverpool. That's just what you expect from him. So it's kind of overlooked the fact that Robertson has barely put a foot wrong for Scotland, aside from his shooting in the last year, I would say. I think he's been very good, actually. And Tierney doubles up with him so well on that side. That's us talked about every single player in the team, with the exception of two who were possibly two of our best performers on the night, which is your favourite, Grant Hanley, and of course Billy Gilmore in front of him. Gilmore, I think, it's the first time I'd actually watched him play in person against Moldova. I think he's the most exciting player Scotland have had since I started going to watch Scotland. He is, there are weaknesses, there are flaws in his game, of course there are, he's 20 years old, but he's phenomenal. The space he always finds himself, and the fact that it is very much he gets the ball and it's like looks up one touch and he'll ping it 40 yards. It's like watching a young, a young Luka Modric or a young Xavi or someone like that.
I was speaking about Billy Gilmour earlier today. And I was thinking, right, so who do you compare him to from a Scottish perspective? And so for my money, and I know this might be, maybe you might consider it a low bar, I don't know, but I would say that the best midfielder for Scotland recently, and not even recently, maybe over the last generation, might be Barry Ferguson, in terms of he never gave the ball away and was underrated, and was probably underrated because he played for Rangers, in my opinion. And there was also the suggestion that he would look to play it sideways or backwards. Now, whether that was true or not, I don't know. But what I would say is that Billy Gilmour, he's similar to Ferguson in that he's so comfortable in terms of bringing the ball, like demanding the ball, even if he isn't in that much space. He demands the ball. And the thing is, he doesn't always get it. He doesn't always get the ball, but he was constantly demanding the ball. And he is so comfortable in terms of spinning away from his closest opponent and then playing the ball forward. And that's obviously a lot easier when you have Dykes and Adams and McGinn, who's in a more forward position. But I don't think I've been this excited about a Scotland player since. So I remember Barry Ferguson in I think it was the Euro 2000 qualifier.
Yeah,
I remember getting mixed up here against England, and Barry Ferguson was man of the match. And I was like, this is a potentially a world class Scottish midfielder. Now that, in my opinion, didn't quite work out, and I thought Barry Ferguson was excellent. He wasn't world class. Billy Gilmour might also not be world class, but I do think at this stage of his development, he is as good as I've seen from a Scottish perspective.
Yeah, he's undroppable. I said that after the England game, and only of course for him to not be able to play the game. But I said, you won't see him back out of the Scotland team for 15 years, and I stand by that. He is so good. His impact on the game again, it wasn't that he influenced the game hugely against Austria, but what it was is he's a calming presence, and that's weird when he's the youngest player on the park. But one of our big problems for a long time, and it's been better under Steve Clarke in general, but one of our problems for a long time has been giving the ball away in these big games. We panic, we don't keep the ball, we don't have those spells where we've just got the ball for 15, 20, 30 seconds. We take the sting out of the game a wee bit, we impose ourselves a little bit on our opponents. Gilmour suddenly gives you that because you will give him the ball and you will get it back and you're not worrying. And that comes with a bunch of other players round about him that are also composed on the ball. You talked about Hendry earlier, Tierney the same. Even someone like Grant Hanley, who gets a lot of abuse for being, or did get a lot of abuse for being a big lump, he passes the ball fine. He plays for a Norwich team where he has to be able to do that because that's how they play. So you are suddenly looking at a very capable team. And that's, again, missing. We were missing several players there. Scott McTominay, a regular player for Man United, wasn't playing. Ryan Jack, who's been nothing short of excellent for Scotland, wasn't playing. Ryan Fraser wasn't available. Who else? There was one other. James Forrest, another player who could have been influencing those games. Some of them are maybe not starters, but we were missing a few names. And you suddenly start looking and going, well, we've got a bit of depth in this squad as well.
Do you find, I always think that speaking about international football is probably more knee-jerk because campaigns are so short. So you speak about a club team, but they'll have like a 36 or 38 game campaign or whatever. But then when you speak about an international side, they might just have a 10 game campaign to qualify for the World Cup. So it probably is more knee-jerk. But do you find yourself being confused by the Scotland team in terms of, I watch them and think, this team, like literally I've watched them like this week and thought twice, against Denmark, they're not good at all. Against Moldova, they're entirely kind of unconvincing. And then against Austria, I'm like, actually, we're very good. And that's kind of been how I felt about this Steve Clarke Scotland team for the duration of his tenure.
Yeah.
And I do find them quite confusing. So is it that we are, are we good? Are we decent? Should I be getting my hopes up, or are these fleetingly good performances? Are they not going to be representative going forward? I don't really know. I find them quite a weird team to get my head around.
It's hard for me to be objective. Essentially, I've now had my club or country managed by Steve Clark for about 4 years, and there's been nothing but success in that period. So he took over at Kelly, and we immediately were like 1-0 every game. We had a calendar year where we won the most points in Scotland, most points in the Premiership. He then takes over as Scotland manager, immediately takes us to the next tournament. So for me, it's hard to not have an unshaken belief in the fact that he knows what he's doing and he's going to get you there. But you do start doubting yourself. There have been moments with that. I think a couple of, when he was still persisting with the back four, which again, we can talk about whether it can go back to. But at that point, we didn't have footballers that could play out from the back, and we really struggled to keep the ball. And that was, I think, one of the reasons for moving to the five at the back, which he did. At that point, I was doubting myself somewhat. I'm thinking, is this the same manager? Because they weren't doing any of the same things that, his Kelly team did in terms of the principles that he had as a manager. But now you see those principles again. But you doubt yourself when you're sitting watching that Moldova game in particular. And I'm like, we've got nothing here. We're not, we scored a goal. We barely looked at scoring again. I watched the highlights back, and in hindsight, we did actually have a few good chances that you kind of, when you're playing badly and you're kind of being down on your team, you kind of forget the good chances that you did miss, the Gilmore one that you really should score and things like that. But I'm exactly in the same boat as you, because I look at this squad and I have supreme confidence in some of those players that they are excellent footballers. And then you sometimes watch the performance and think, am I overrating these guys? But I watch them play for their clubs to a really high standard. And so, yeah, I do remain quite confused about them. And one thing I would like to caveat this with is I think Austria are terrible. I really don't think they're a good team at all.
So they are. So I do think Austria are poor. I think they... It's funny, when the draw was made, I thought we lucked out in terms of Denmark as a number one seed and Austria as a number two seed. I think with the benefit of hindsight, there might be a lot of number one seeds that don't play as well as Denmark. I mean, Denmark are literally rattling teams left, right, and centre. And our 2-0 defeat maybe doesn't look quite as bad in context. But I do think we lucked out in terms of Austria as a number two seed. They might be as bad as it gets,
they
number two seed-wise.
At the Euros, they won two games in their group, and they beat Macedonia, and they beat Ukraine in the final game. And they also then obviously took Italy kind of all the way, essentially, in the last 16 game. However, I think they would have, if they had been in our group, which they wouldn't have been because they were not bottom seeds, but if they had been replaced Scotland in our group, I think they would have got 0 points. I don't think they would have done anything in our group. So I think they were slightly fortunate with their draw in that they played North Macedonia, who were the worst team at the tournament, and they played Ukraine, who were terrible as well. And you've seen that from Ukraine, I think, unable to win a game in qualifying so far, or if they've won, it's been one. So I think we have to caveat it with the fact that Austria aren't great, but at the same time, and they got pumped 5-2 in Israel literally several days before that. But at the same time, it doesn't matter. We've played lots of teams who aren't great, who are worse than Austria, and we have not been able to go away and beat them. And if we have been able to go away and beat them, it's been smash and grab. That wasn't smash and grab. That was, we're going to turn up, we're going to impose ourselves on you. Yes, you have to ride your luck at times, but you didn't come away from the game thinking, well, we didn't quite deserve that. We kind of were fortunate. So, I mean, the fact is, again, I was saying we talked about every player. We haven't even mentioned Craig Gordon because he had one really good save and very little else to do. I'm in that boat, but I think they obviously had the safety net. They won their Nations League group. Talking about them being rubbish, they obviously aren't that bad, but they won their Nations League group. So they're kind of, as you said earlier, going to get a playoff place anyway, pretty much. And that's the only worry in terms of, obviously, Israel have to go there. I think Israel are playing them away. And I've kind of had that in my head as a wee safety net. If we only draw with Israel, for example,
Quite sure.
We probably
the inevitable one draw is coming.
But when you know, it's like, well, they've still got to go to Austria, and they might well drop points there. It doesn't matter how bad your second seeds are, you still have to actually finish ahead of them. And this, the fact is, we've taken the 4 points. So now, what I said at the start is, you take 6 points off each. And I always say, if you can take 6 points off the bottom seeds, and you get four against the team round about you, you'd be very unlucky not to. And so when people were being, you know, quite pessimistic, and you can understand that after the first two games, when we drew with Austria and we drew with Israel away, it's like, Israel away is not a bad result. You'd hope to beat them, but it's not a bad result. Austria at home is a bad result. You would want to win that game, but it's like, well, you just means you have to go and make up for that now away from home, which we did. So now we are...
But what I would say about that is, so again, I would say you've always been more positive than myself, but we generally don't do that. So you're saying we drew with Austria at home, and then we have to counter that elsewhere in the group, but generally we don't.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you kind of thought we would do, or you certainly had a belief that we would do. I didn't, but again, I thought we were excellent against Austria on Tuesday.
But you have been saying over the last doubleheader, you know, you still fancied that we were going to be in a pretty good position if we could get any sort of result. You've been negative at times in the past, but I think you still had that belief as well from when you were on the podcast, you know, the other, it was after the Denmark game, right? And you said, you know what, yeah, it was a bad performance, but you'd been tallying up, you know, the table, and this, here's
I still had some faith.
Yeah.
Some faith.
And so ultimately, we've had one bad result and one good result in this group. We had the bad result was a draw at home to Austria, the good result was the away, and everything else has been what you expect. Or as I say, what you expect if you're targeting second, which is what we are targeting. So now it's just about going out, hopefully getting the job done in the next three games. We don't want to have to rely on anything off Denmark at Hampden, but at the same time, I am not going to sit here and say it's impossible for us to beat Denmark at Hampden either, because you know we can do it.
You would like to think, bear in mind, they'll have... So qualified. Essentially, they've already qualified.
Yeah.
So you would like to think that if there was some kind of scenario where we need to get something from Denmark, be that a point, be it 3 points, then we would be in a slightly better position because they've already qualified. And I'm not saying they're going to take it easy on us, but still, you'd like to think we'd be in a decent position to take something for them.
Just think back to 2010 qualifying it was, and it was the Holland game. We played the Netherlands at Hampden in the last game, and I think we had to beat them actually to...
Was that a David Weir mistake?
Yeah, and David Weir fell over. But we actually played really well in that game, and they went on to reach the World Cup final, but they were kind of on the beach, if that's a thing for international football, when the game's played in November. But they were metaphorically, they were not there. And they do ease off when they've qualified. It's natural. And so, again, we hope we don't need to worry about it. But I think we will finish second in the group now. I'll put my neck on the line. I think we will beat Israel like 1-0 or 2-1. And then we'll probably draw one of the two away games, but we'll probably get second anyway. That's what I think will happen. Is there anything else to add in this Scotland game?
No, I think I will also stick my neck on the line and we'll say that Scotland will finish second.
Good.
And then win the semi-finals. As it stands, we're going to be seeded for the semi-finals.
Which means
it's not complicated, but there's 12 semi-finalists, which sounds like that's too many teams for the semi-finals. But
the Intertoto Cup all over again.
Uh-huh. So 12 semi-finalists and then 6 finalists and then 3 teams qualify thereafter. We are currently seeded. There's some decent teams that we might come up against. So I think we might need to ride our luck when it comes to the draw.
Yes. And I mean, there are the potential for them being some not very good teams in there as well. So yeah, and if we can get that seed and you're at home in the semi-final, which I think could make a big difference, but then it's luck of the draw. We got unlucky with the Nations League one the last time. If we got told we finished second, we had 2 games at Hampden against teams who haven't been good enough to qualify automatically for the World Cup. You can't disagree with that as an option. You know,
no, we've done
some of those teams might be better than us. Well, we'll save all of that discussion. That'll come back up in a month's time when we have some genuinely massive matches in October. What we will do now is we will delve back into the archives and we will be going on for the next one in our list of classic, most memorable Scotland men's matches. Most memorable matches, which only stretches back to 2019 and therefore don't include, because we've been so long in doing this, any of the ones that are related to the last Euros or indeed this win in Austria, which might not have made it in anyway. But we are going back now to the 14th of November, 1984. For the second time in a row, because I think the last podcast also discussed a game in this campaign. It was qualifying for the 1986 World Cup. I Feel For You by Chaka Khan was at number one. Not a song I'm familiar with, but...
No, I am. I'm familiar with that song. It's a decent track.
And the two big kind of issues in the country at that point were the miners' strike. That was ongoing at the time. Fuck Margaret Thatcher. And
Good that she's dead.
Yeah, and the famine in Ethiopia, so I think a week after this was when Band-Aid got recorded. So those were the kind of two big news stories of the time, and that's what was going on. Back at Hampden Park, there were 70,000 people turned up to watch Scotland play Spain. Now, Spain had been European Championship finalists. They'd lost to France in the final, yep. Or 2-0 to France. This was only a few months after that. Scotland had kicked off their campaign. So again, this is, again, slightly old ground for some of the people who listened to the discussion of the Wales one on the previous one. Scotland were in a group with Wales, Iceland and Spain. We'd kicked off the campaign by beating Iceland 3-0 at Hampden, and then we played Spain in our second game. And obviously it was pretty much, you were thinking at the time, if we can beat Spain here, we're already in a pretty strong position with this group. Scotland lined up. Jim Leighton was in goals, Steve Nicol, Alec McLeish, Willie Miller, Arthur Alberston was playing left back, and we had Betts, Souness, McStay and Cooper, and then Mo Johnston and Kenny Dalglish. A pretty strong Scotland team, lots of the kind of big names there. Do you remember, were you at this game, Sean?
No,
or do you remember?
No, I died. So this was slightly beyond my time. And what I would say is, so for people of my generation, I suppose, for want of a better description, then Scotland beating France 2-0 in the 1990 qualifiers is probably the kind of epitome of a Scotland performance. The best Scotland performance ever is beating France 2-0 at Hampden in 1989. For people who are slightly older than me, I think this result and this performance is what they regard as the finest Scotland performance and then certainly result of that they could recall.
This is one my dad always talks about is,
I mean, it was, as you said, it was the against the European Championship finalists. This was a good team. Funnily enough, I think it was Fowler said it right, here's the game that we're looking at. I don't remember this. It's been a World Cup qualifier at all. And I don't know what it is about my kind of childlike mind that doesn't recall anything from the 1986 World Cup qualifiers, but does recall the 1986 World Cup. Mm. So I was like, right, so this must be a European Championship game. So I kind of Googled it, kind of European Championship. And obviously it wasn't that. And I suppose what I thought was quite interesting was, so we obviously beat Spain 3-1 in this game. And as much as we celebrate the fact that Scotland qualified for 6 World Cups out of 7, and rightly so, but and obviously we now kind of chastise the fact that we generally don't qualify for World Cups or European Championships, we generally qualified by the skin of our teeth. So whether that was to do with a single point or whether that was to do with... So in this example, we qualified for... So we had to play Australia in a playoff, but we managed that through goal difference from the game against Wales. So we've generally done it by the skin of teeth, but this was probably the best performance, in my opinion, other than the win against France, which I think was 1989. It was exceptional, and I think Kenny Dalglish's influence. So even though he was getting on a bit by now, and even in 1984, so he was named in the squad, even though he'd just had a knee operation. However, Jockstein named him because he thought he would be back. And I think it was his 96th cap for Scotland. He only got 102. It was his final ever goal for Scotland. But regardless, bear in mind how good Spain were, this was a deserved win for Scotland. We were the better team and possibly could have won by more. And what I thought was most interesting, and it's at the same time quite frustrating, is that between maybe 1983 to 1990, for example, we produced Scotland strikers who were excellent, but for one reason or another, didn't quite make their mark. So that would be Charlie Nicholas, Mo Johnson, and Frank McAvenny. Like, genuinely, McAvenny was probably the least talented of the three, but Nicholas and Johnson were exceptional, far better than anything we have now. But for whatever reason, they didn't quite, from a Scotland perspective, do as well as they could have done. But this game against Spain, and funnily enough, the game against France that I mentioned in 1989, Mo Johnson was exceptional and absolutely showed exactly what he was capable of.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was my thought. And more, you can throw in another name there, which is Steve Archibald, who was just signed for Barcelona, would go on to be the third top scorer in the Spanish league that season, sat on the bench throughout this game. So you've got a Barcelona player sitting on the bench for Scotland against Spain. So I guess there's a bit of a power play there as well. But that was one of the things that jumped out at me, because you're looking through, and Nicholas was on the bench for this one as well. You're looking through that list of names that weren't playing, Gordon Strachan. So there's a quote from before the game from the Spain manager, Miguel Munoz, was just, "Why no Strachan?" That was a quote that was in the Herald from the day before. So Strachan the previous year, 1983, had been voted fourth in the Ballon d'Or. Michel Platini, Kenny Dalglish, Alan Simonson, Danish player, and Strachan were the top four.
And, imagine having two Scotland players in the top four for the Ballon d'Or.
It's coming, Sean. So their manager was obviously slightly confused, and it said in the paper, it said basically the journalist writing it said, "Well, hopefully Paul McStay kind of shows him why there's no Strachan." I think McStay did have a particularly good game in this one as well.
What was it? So I think it was Miguel Munoz.
Yeah.
That was the Spanish manager, but he, funnily enough, so he was the manager for Real Madrid when they beat Eintracht Frankfurt 7-3. So already had a kind of link to Hamden. But he had a quote afterwards, and he said, "The Scots were fantastic. It was the most powerful Scotland side I have ever seen. I was not disappointed with my team. We were simply beaten by the better side," which probably sums up like how good Scotland were. I know we can over-egg it. I know we can like get misty-eyed when it comes to Scotland. But the fact that you can look at that. So I watched the game today. It had been uploaded, oddly enough, in its entirety on YouTube with Spanish commentary. But the fact that you could have Davy Cooper and Kenny Dalglish and Mo Johnson and Paul McStay and Jim Bett, who maybe we'll talk about later. He had like a kind of weird career. But I suppose to touch on Dalglish, like his importance, and like there's been so many players who have been regarded as maybe the next kind of Dalglish, and probably came in that next few years. Nicholas Johnson, and it's never happened for any of them for whatever reason, and they all had the ability to do so, but we've struggled to have a decent, not even decent, and I know like Dalglish was world class, but we've never had anything even remotely approaching that from a forward since.
Yeah, and so we talked through the game. I guess it's Mo Johnson you're talking about forward there. He was obviously in top form in this game. And a lot of these games, to be honest, it does seem like a player that popped up in big games all the time, because a lot of these games we end up talking about Mo Johnson. So both the first two goals I thought could be characterised quite unfairly as shite corners followed by his doing something on the second ball. Now that would be a bit of an oversell of it, but the first goal is a corner that gets headed clear, and it's a wonderful strike by Stevie Nicol at the edge of the box, arcing
at a very low diving header. Like, why does he only use his feet? It's probably ankle height.
But he gets it in, and again, that's all you need to do. And then the second one's again a nice cross in after the kind of second ball, and then he nods it past the keeper again. Scotland, racing into two goal leads, and as will always happen, if Scotland ever race into a two goal lead in a game, they are contractually obliged to concede a goal. So in the second
half, a dreadful goal.
It was Jim Leighton. It was like he fell over, or it was a cross comes in, and he just kind of.
I don't know how to say what it was like. It was like Jim Leighton was diving for a different shot at goal. Like he dived low, but the ball went high.
But it was headed into the ground and it bounced over him. And it doesn't make a lick of sense.
So basically what happened was I think the cross had come in, and then Leighton had come for it, and then second guessed himself and then retreated back. But then I still don't understand what happened next. So basically like the header. It was a header down, which went high, but he'd dive low. It was really, really weird.
And it's one of those things for me with Jim Leighton. Now, I know that Jim Leighton had a fantastic career as a goalkeeper. He obviously won the Cup Winners' Cup for Aberdeen. I've watched the final of that before. You could be forgiven for thinking Jim Leighton was rubbish if you watched a lot of his career. He had a very strange career, because you think we've talked about Morocco in the 98 World Cup. Now, I appreciate that was a whole 14 years after this and he was in his 40s. You've got something like that where he falls over. You've obviously got at Man United being a colossal failure there. Was he actually good?
No, he was, but he did have... Like maybe a lot of goalkeepers, he had goals that he could have done better for.
Yes, and this was one of them. But fortunately, we would go on to seal the game. It was Kenny Dalglish kind of cut in from the right hand side in a kind of beautiful curled effort with his left foot. And my dad always said to he obviously as I said earlier, this was a game that was that James McFadden scored the goal against Lithuania. Mm-hmm. Qualifying, which was not dissimilar to this, and the first thing my dad said to me after that was just like Kenny Dalglish against Spain, and I was like, it's not quite that. Well, it was the same stakes, and in both times I think it put us 3-1 up in the game, but it was a tremendous goal, and that put him level, as you said, with Dennis Law in the Scotland goal scoring record. And I think there was probably a belief at that point that he would go on and beat that, but he obviously never did, so they finished up level. But 30 goals for Scotland is not something that looks like being broken anytime soon. I mean, maybe John McGinn, if we let him play against like rubbish teams all the time, we might get quite close, but it doesn't look like something that I don't think any of our current strikers are going to be troubling the 30s. I'd be quite surprised if they were troubling the 10s, to be honest.
I'd be pleasantly surprised. I suppose from the Spanish side, I suppose one of the most... I went through everybody. So I know when Tony does these things, he generally tries to find, like, I don't know, like a kind of sex scandal I don't know, something they've done in their private life, which in fairness, I've tried to do as well. But the only thing I could find was is it Andoni Goikoetxea?
Yeah, the butcher of Bilbao.
The butcher of Bilbao. So I didn't realise that, because it occasionally pops up on my Twitter timeline every now and again, that game against Barcelona, where I think it's like a cup final.
Yeah.
And they're just kicking fuck at each other. But ultimately, what that stemmed from, as far as I'm aware, was he broke Maradona's ankle.
Have you seen the tackle?
I have not seen the tackle, but I believe it's a bad one.
Yes. So it's one of those that is kind of like his foot makes contact with Maradona like halfway up his leg when his foot's planted in the ground. So it's not not the most pleasant tackle.
But according to his Wikipedia page, he actually kept the boot that he broke Maradona's ankle with in a glass case in a kind of celebratory thing. And then he also ended Bernd Schuster's career, as far as I'm aware. So he had a dreadful tackle on him as well. And as which is why, as far as I'm aware, this cup game with Bilbao and Barcelona got out of hand. It was entirely to do with him. But thankfully, he didn't maim or kill any Scotland players that evening.
So yeah, he started this because that was the 1984 Copa del Rey final. It was only a few months before this game. And yeah, there's footage of like Maradona like fly kicking people and stuff like that, because it was one of his first games back. But yeah, he had been banned. He was started the 84-85 season with an 18-game ban as a result of
involvement
in the brawl. He got reduced to seven. But he'd previously been banned for 10 games for the tackle on Maradona as well. But it makes him sound right like a guy that's all he's got going for him. You know, that was a highlight of his career. Athletic Bilbao had won the league 2 years running before that, and he was a big part of that team. He was a successful player as well, and he was the player that scored the goal in this game. But yeah, an interesting character. Also playing for him was Jose Camacho, who went on to be the manager at the 2002 World Cup that had the really sweaty armpits. So there's that footage of him in 2002. But talking of the aggression from Spain, it's funny to think of that now because it's like a bunch of wee tiny guys passing the ball about. But Jock Steen's quote before the game was, Jock Steen's before the game was saying we're going to take the game to them because match fire with fire, because that's what they were kind of known for at the time, is being quite aggressive. And he said the aggression will be there. That's a vital part of our game. The Spaniards needn't think they are here for a nice game of football. It would be daft for us to change our whole pattern, but we'll go after them sensibly. And it's like, go after them sensibly. Like, yeah, we will attempt to maim and hurt these guys, but in a nice, sensible fashion.
Sensibly so.
And after
I did enjoy, there's an advertising hoarding behind the goals. I think it's the second half, and it says, Adam for scrap. I was thinking to myself, right, see in 1984, how do you do anything about that? See, Adam for scrap. see if you're interested in that. How do you find out about Adam for scrap? Like, you have to go into Yellow Pages. I don't know. I have Googled it, and it turns out that they are still about. So Adam for scrap is still about. How you went about that in November 1984? I don't know.
It's almost a nice throwback to the big ones that are at Hampden just now, which is for Billy Bowie waste management. It's pretty much the same thing, right?
Honestly, the amount of times I've been at Hampden and then watched Scotland and then afterwards, I cannot resist phoning Billy Bowie to speak to him about waste management.
And the match report for the Herald kind of going on, it said, this is kind of, you can imagine this in reverse now, it says, having to dodge swinging boots and tackles, which are more commonly seen in a wrestling ring, Scotland kept their cool, their discipline, and most importantly, their determination. You could quite imagine like reading that written about us, like the reverse in a foreign newspaper now, because it's kind of our reputation now as a bunch of hackers, even if it's not always true. But yeah, it's... I think this is one of the things of football in that era. It was attritional. Every time I watch games back, it is aggressive, it is attritional, and you have a respect for the quality of players that show up and play. You know, in terms of the good quality footballers being able to do something in amongst that. Do I have anything else to add, Sean, or are we...
Only, in terms of what you've mentioned, see the second goal, so Mo Johnson's second goal. So Jim Bett was... I mean, he was kind of not scythed down because he didn't go down, but he was very much fouled. And then he done one of those things where it was like, but you've just been kicked, but you're still trying to stay on your feet.
Yeah.
So he kind of stayed on his feet for about 10 yards, and then he got the cross in, and then Mo Johnson, it looks like bad defending, but he kind of peeled off the defender to kind of head home. And the thing I'm most like about Mo Johnson is, and again, this is relevant to Scottish strikers throughout the 80s, his shots were exactly the same as every other Scottish player's shots, but somehow Mo Johnson made them more sexy than anybody else. I don't know if they were higher, I don't know if they were lower, but Mo Johnson somehow made his Scottish strip, especially shorts, more sexy than everybody else that was playing that night.
Well, that's a perfect way to end the podcast, isn't it, Sean, to talk about Mo Johnson's sexy shorts. There's a title for it as well. So thanks, Sean, for joining us this evening. I hope that all the listeners enjoy this. There's loads of Patreon content going out soon as well. And I hope you enjoy your football this weekend. So thanks very much, Sean.
No worries. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.